It's always a good idea to start with. I did, of course, send off an abstract, which, of course, wasn't an abstract, since it wasn't abstracted for anything that actually existed. It was actually just a sort of vague promissory note. And as I was sitting in rural France at the time, well, I just wrote something down. This is my way of saying probably don't pay too much attention to what the abstract actually says, partly because I've come to think that some things I thought were problems aren't in fact problems, which may or may not be progress, of course. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about Galen and powers, in particular natural powers or natural faculties. We've already heard a little bit about that, and I agree pretty much entirely with Roberta's characterization of what distinguishes Galen's natural powers from the more general and ramified Aristotelian sense or senses of dunamis and the correlative energeia. I will just repeat or re-stress that two related things. One, that the powers are, as it were, active powers. And secondly, that that's to be construed in a particular way. They're active powers of producing things. And so they're not powers to have produced them. If you've got a natural power in this sense, it's a power for some ongoing process. Now, the ongoing process may result in, as it were, epiphenomenally, if you want to put it that way, some state of maintenance. Indeed, that's ideally what nutrition does, when you, which is one of his basic natural powers. When you take in nutrition, of course, there's all sorts of things going on, but provided you're not overeating or undereating, you're maintaining exactly the same bodily morphology as a result of nutrition. This is of a piece with a general feature, I think, of Galen's notion of what it is to be an aition or an aitia, that which is owed to the Stoics ultimately, but is given a distinctive twist, which is that aitia are causes of processes or ongoing sets of events. There are no causes of states as such. Now, of course, certain things may appear to be states, the state of relative equilibrium or something like that, but if they're to be accounted for in terms of a dynamic competition between opposing forces, then that's going to be enough to be able to say, at the basic level, that there is actual causation going on. It's just that the end result is going to be, as I say, some sort of equilibrium. In a passage of on the movement of the muscles, for instance, he considers the case of a bird, which is hovering. He says, well, what's actually happening there? And he says, well, there are two things going on. It has a natural tendency to fall, which is being precisely counterbalanced by its own active capacity to rise. There are two things actually going on that result in an equilibrium. And that's why I'm inclined to think, and I've written about this elsewhere, that as I say, states as such don't require causes. There can, of course, be causes of their having come to be, but there's no continuing cause of them being. But that's, in a sense, by the by. Well, let me turn to the first serious slide, and this really just sums up some of the things, at any rate, that Roberto was saying. So natural activities are coordinate with their respective natural powers. The coordination between dynamis and energeia is, of course, reflects Aristotelian practice, well, in most cases, of course, apart from the pure actualities. But the character is narrower than its Aristotelian counterpart in that such powers are active only, properly so-called. I agree with Roberto about that. Although Galen does recognize passive potentialities, he doesn't do so in that terminology. He tends to talk in terms of suitabilities, again, borrowing Stoic, well, partly Stoic vocabulary. And these are not associated with, also they're not associated with causes, activities, things actually going on. They're simply the suitability of something to be affected by something which is active in the appropriate sense. The natural activities, the physikai energiae, derived from the essential nature and function of the item, could be an organ, could be a tissue, could be a fully developed animal. We can talk about these things at a variety of different levels, and that's going to be something else I'm going to be talking about. The Aristotelian distinction between rational and non-rational powers or capacities, which figures so much in Metaphysics Theta, plays no important role, which is not to say that Galen couldn't incorporate it, it's just to say that he doesn't spend much, if any, time dealing with it. And equally, There's no issue, as of course there is in Aristotle, as to whether you should say that the power continues to exist as a power when it's in fact being actualized. Aristotle thinks you should say that only if certain specific conditions are met. Galen is perfectly happy to say, well, it's the power's there all the time. It's because the power explains the activity, it had better be there all the time, because the power, in fact, is going to turn out to be a type of cause. Indeed, in most cases, a type of idea synectica, again, a piece of terminology borrowed ultimately probably from the Stoics, but given a particular twist in Galen and in other medical writers, namely the sort of cause which is co-temporal and covariant with its effects. Okay, I shall move on. I don't intend to spend much of my time reading because that makes me even more boring, I think. I will read some of this. As I say, this is a fairly inchoate condition. I was putting touches to it on the plane last night, but unfortunately not finishing touches. Anyway, so this treatise called Natural Faculties, Natural Powers, Galen seeks to distinguish these various natural dunamis, which both generate and maintain the human animal. And the basic ones are those of generation, growth, and nutrition, as he says. Now, these in their turn are associated with, and I use that vague terminology deliberately, with other, but as he says, more basic powers of specific attraction, assimilation, retention, and expulsion. And for those of you who've still got your earlier handouts, there's a text in Roberto's handout. This is text 13, which has makes a similar claim. Now, so attraction, assimilation, retention, and expulsion. Sometimes even those powers are broken down. So there's going to be a power. There's going to be a stage of, or at least a stage of initial adhesion, followed by a process of assimilation. Now, and I shall just put up a slide, but I will not talk through it. And that these, look at the last couple of sentences of that, that these metabolic powers are in some sense fundamental, at least to the economy, preservation, and indeed to the original growth and to the embryogenesis of the animal, or indeed plant, is underscored in various other places. And as far as Galen can judge, at least some of the time, there might not be much more to be said than just that. There are these powers, this is what they do, this is how they cash out in action, this is how they're related to the overall functional economy of the animal in question. Although, of course, there's going to be a lot to be said about their interrelations, but maybe you can't say anything much more about the power itself. Well, that's not quite right. It's true that Galen introduces the notion of a power, as we'll see in a slide in a minute, as a sort of placeholder for whatever it is that's responsible for the particular activity type of functioning in question. He doesn't just rest with that. He certainly doesn't think that that's the last word on the issue. He doesn't fall into the trap of Molière explanation. He doesn't think you explain why opium puts you to sleep by saying it has a virtus dormitiva. It does, and in a sense trivially it does, but that's the first word and not the last word. But more importantly, so that would be to say, well, look, okay, you shouldn't just stop there, but maybe we can't go much further. But crucially, and why he insists on these particular powers, and they can come at a variety of levels, generic and specific, as we'll see, is because, fundamentally because, of his rejection of a particular Greek physical alternative, namely the discontinuous physics of the atomists and people who are influenced by them. Discontinuous both in the sense that you've got small bits of unbreakable stuff, as it were, and discontinuous also, at least in many of the developments of it, in terms of the structure of space and time as well. Although that's not of any importance in this context. So these powers then can't simply be reduced to simple mechanical principles. The great mistake of the earlier physicians, Erasistratus and Asclepiades, in this regard, according to Galen, and this is their major opponents in this particular text, is to suppose that all of the fluid dynamics of the body, which is one of his major interests in this text, can be accounted for by postulates such as that of horror vacui. And I'll leave out of account now whether that's supposed to be an explanatory principle or something else. The same issue crops up with like to like. Does that explain something, or does it just simply name a type of effect? But I won't be pursuing that. Any further now. It's not that Galen rejects the principle as such. Indeed, he invokes it in accounting for how blood can be propelled through the arteries by the successive contraction and dilation of their coats. But he thinks of that as being, as he would put it simply, instrumental. There's something that's causing that contraction and dilation, and that is, as it turns out, as we find in On the Cause of Pulses, a power of the heart. But I won't pursue that any further either. It's not that he rejects such mechanical principles, it's just that he thinks that they can't account for the specificity of natural attractions, interactions in the body, which need to be explained in terms of specific attractive and eliminative powers, for some sense of explain. Thus, he thinks these guys can't account for the fact that the kidneys attract and concentrate urine, rather than any liquid indiscriminately. By a simple application of any such principle. And the same thing goes for the explanation of the filling of the bladder with urine by way of the ureters and its subsequent expulsion and so on and so forth. And this again is because a merely mechanical principle, at least of this sort, can't discriminate between the types of fluid. Or actually, more precisely, it can't make the appropriate sorts of discriminations. In a slide that I may have time to show later on, Galen says that the tendency of empty space to be refilled tends to draw up the lighter and finer elements first, and then the heavier and grosser ones afterwards. But that would, of course, mean there'd be only one way in which these things would happen, and it would tend to work really well for, like, fine liquids or fluids and not for others. But, as I say, he thinks you can't put together a picture of the functional structure of the body without acknowledging and doing justice to the evident fact that different organs work on different sorts of stuff and have some way of getting that stuff into themselves, or in some cases producing it. And the hopelessness of this kind of explanation, he thinks, is paralleled by what he takes to be, quite rightly in my view, the hopelessness of the Epicurean attempt to explain atomism in terms of little hooky things coming out and catching up and rebounding with other little hooky things and pulling them back again. He says, well, that's pretty bad in and of itself, but it clearly can't account for the fact that magnetic forces is transmissible through successive pieces of iron. You can get a magnet and put a piece of iron underneath it, and another one underneath that. And he says, well, and what's going on? Do some of these things pass through, some of them rebound, and so on? It's just not good enough. You've got to say that there's a force of attraction, but you can't say, well, the force of attraction is reducible in some sense to the mechanical facts of the interaction of atoms of a particular type at the sub-perceptible level, since there's just not enough in those kinds of explanations to do the requisite work. Now, of course, to say that something like a power of attraction isn't reducible to those sorts of principles isn't to say that it isn't reducible. Or isn't to say that and if reducible is too strong a word, as it might very well be, or beg too many appropriate questions, isn't even to say that we might not want to attempt to give an account for, an explanatory account for, what, as it were, presents itself as an attractive power in terms of something else. But then again, we might not. And this is a much later but relevant example in the history of science. Consider the tortuous history of the reception of Newtonian mechanics in France, where precisely the objection was, well, you've got things doing things at a distance, but no explanation how they can do that. And Newton, of course, himself was well aware that was a sort of hole in his. He wanted to be able to give some sort of account where the attraction would, as it were, simply be the effect of the operation of more easily intelligible interactions, but found it couldn't do it. And again, of course, that doesn't mean that it can't be done. Alright, finally, well, not finally, but here's another text. Just draw your attention towards the, as it were, an appetite for appropriate quality and an aversion to, or as it were, a hatred for the alien one. I think perhaps Brooke will be talking about the similar things next time. I don't want to, when she talks, I don't want to tread on her toes about that. In any case, that specific language or what that language does is not central to what I am interested in. So, but Galen's aware that this sort of, blithe introduction of powers as being, in some sense, explanatory or at least providing a framework for the attempt at explanation, he's aware that this is, in some ways, pretty unsatisfactory as it stands. And early on in this treatise, he acknowledges, and this is this, this passage, so long as we don't know the essence of the activating cause, the usia, we call it a power. Thus we say that there's in the veins a hematopoietic power, a digestive power in the stomach, etc., and in each of the other parts, a specific power corresponding to its activity. And it should be added, if the part has more than one activity, then there's going to be more than one power. They are going to be in a one-one correspondence. So if we were to investigate methodically how many and what sorts of powers there are, we need to start from their products or outcomes or sometimes even effects, erga. For each product comes from a specific activity. I'm using activity to translate energia in this context. There's no, I think, wholly suitable or acceptable equivalent. Activity is the most common way of translating energia in these sorts of contexts, where it doesn't just mean actuality of some sort. I'm sometimes inclined to think that function might, in one of its senses, might do all right for energia, but I also think that function, in another of its senses, doesn't do too badly for crea, which is going to crop up in a bit too. And each activity comes from a specific cause, so there's a commitment there to there being a cause, and that's a fairly strong commitment. But as long as we don't know what that is, note the essence in the first part, we call it a power. So, in the veins, and Galen thinks that blood, well, venous blood, is largely elaborated in the veins. Well, there's a power of blood making. There must be, because that's where it's made. But of course, as this passage shows, again, that's going to be the first word, but not necessarily the last word. Indeed, not at all the last word. And powers are conceptualized as causes in, on the, powers of simple drugs, which we saw in Philip's talk earlier on, relatively early on in that treatise. He says, a power is an active cause, an idea drastic air. But they're causes whose actual nature or structure is not fully understood. And Galen says the same thing in causes of pulses. We call this cause which produces, demiurgusan, there's that word again, the pulses, whatever it may be, and even if we're ignorant of its essence, a dunamis, because of its being capable of effecting, of bringing about the pulses. And also of altering them. That's why it's a synectic cause. And these items are clearly relational. They're powers to produce particular functional consequences, energia, where energia is the proper activity of an organ or system, which produces some result or outcome or product, some ergon. Again, I'm not happy with any of these translations, so I'll be just throwing in the Greek a lot of the time. Right, this is from towards the very beginning of Natural Faculties. We'll inquire into the number and nature of these powers and what the product each of them is, such as to produce, what the ergon of each of them is. By ergon, of course, I mean what's already been generated and completed by their activities, such as blood, flesh, and nerve. So those are going to be examples of erga. That's why effect isn't a particularly happy translation there. And I call the active motion, the kinesis, the activity, and its cause a power. When in the transformation of food into blood, the motion of the food is passive, while that of the vein is active, and similarly, when the limbs are moved, the muscle produces, and the bones undergo the movement. Which makes it perfectly clear, of course, that Galen can deploy, in a certain sense, Aristotle's distinction between action, active and passive, dunamis. It's just that he's not going to use the term dunamis in this context for the passive one. I call the movement of the vein and the muscles activity, that of the food and the bones a result, a symptoma, or a pathema, the first being altered and the latter transported. So two different types of the very basic category of change, alteration and local motion. It's possible also to call the energeia an ergon of nature. For instance, digestion, absorption, blood production. And I could talk at length about these particular sorts of activity, but I obviously don't have time to do it. But not all products may be called activities. Thus, flesh is a product of nature, but not, of course, an activity. Flesh isn't actually doing anything as such. And again, the relational nature of these items is attested shortly afterwards in that... I will read this. So what's called the blood-making dunamis in the veins, as well as every other dunamis, is thus conceived prosti, since it's primarily the cause of the activity, but incidentally also of the product. And that primarily incidentally distinction is important too. Somebody, I think it might have been Philip, mentioned the katasymbikos, powers for katasymbikos results. But note what it is to be katasymbikos in this sense. It's not to be something, as it were, adventitious to the type of thing in question. It's to be causally more remote from the power of the activity. And that's a usage that Galen parallels elsewhere as well. But if the cause is relative, being the cause only of what comes to be as a result of it, and of nothing else, clearly the power also is relative. I'm sure we might want to discuss that. Okay. Now, all of this, all of these powers, he thinks, the appropriate ones, and these are the ones that are going to be involved in generation, growth, and nutrition, roughly speaking, what happens at the stage of the embryo, what happens in the maturation of the young animal, and what happens, at least paradigmatically, although not wholly, during the period of that animal's maturity. These are all types, they involve types of alteration, aloiosis. And again, we have here's roughly how the schema works. So first the parts of the body themselves are produced in embryogenesis, and that's a complex matter too. You get first of all you get histogenesis, you get the production of different tissues, liver stuff, heart stuff, artery coat stuff, and so on. And then of course you get them organized, molded by the diaplasticae dunamis into structures of a certain type. And how they do what they do is going to be a function partly of what they're made of, and partly of what their morphology is in a complicated and not wholly easily construable way. So here's just a general account of. Sorry, that's not it yet. I haven't finished this part. And so, well, yes, I have. So all of these things, by definition, presuppose the relevant powers, and all involve the alteration and assimilation of raw material to the structure in question. That's the generation part, and the growth part. Generation itself involves the actualization of a moulding power. Okay. So this is the general account of aloiosis and how it relates to other very general conceptual items, and I'm not going to talk through that one, but let's just have a quick look at this, because he distinguishes between what he calls primary and compound motions. And in the passage immediately after the one on the last slide I didn't talk through, he distinguishes alteration from change of place. He's given an example of that earlier on anyway, and describes them as the two primary and simple types of motion, while compounded of them are growth, axasis, and wasting, physis, when something becomes bigger, now it means smaller, or vice versa, but preserves its proper form. Then generation and destruction are equally two other kinds of motion. It's not clear whether they're supposed to be primary or derivative, and in what sense a derivative if they are, but it's pretty clear that any case of generation and destruction, any case of the coming into being of some new thing, will at the very least involve other types of process. And whether that means that these are not, as it were, themselves primary types of process is, to a large extent, a theoretical matter. That has to do with your, among other things, with your views on emergence and so on, the relations in question. It's not something that Galen is going to spend much time thinking about or worrying about, as we'll see, I hope, if I have time at the end. But for reasons that I think are non-trivial reasons. The reason why one might think that generation and destruction would be at the very least derivative is that they depend upon the interactions of the hot, cold, the wet, and the dry, which, as we've already seen in earlier contexts for Galen, are in some sense the fundamental or the basic qualities which are responsible for or which dispose of the fundamental types of dynamis. So even though they depend upon these intersections, though, that doesn't necessarily imply that they're wholly reducible to them, wholly reducible in the sense of being completely ontologically reducible to them. Again, I think probably thought that such subtleties needn't be addressed in order to construct a working metaphysics for medicine and physiology. So I'm not going to pursue them much further here, although I'll come back to them a bit later on. Okay. So, common to all of this, then, is the generic notion the generic characterization of kinesis, in its general sense, of change from a pre-existing condition, as contrasted with rest, again in its very general sense, which is the preservation of that condition. Now, as he says, that last claim is pretty much agreed by everybody, but just what things really do change and in what way. And in particular, whether there's really such a thing as genuine qualitative change or alteration is a matter of dispute. Some people, and Galen typically calls them sophists, he says, while conceding that when foods become blood, they're altered in respect of sight, I've got this on the next, sight, taste, and touch, do not agree that they are so altered in reality. And I think, it's not entirely clear from the way Galen sets it up, but I think the next two bullets are supposed to be different ways in which that first one can be realized. These are not, as it were, three coordinate types of things to say. These numbers two and three are versions of number one. So some say that these apparent changes are merely sensory illusions and that nothing actually changes in the underlying substance. And presumably there he's thinking of atomists, perhaps in particular Democritus, and perhaps also the Eleatics. Although, of course, you don't have to say that because nothing actually changes in the underlying substance or substances, that these changes are really illusory. That would be to say, that would be presumably to suppose that any kind of claim about emergence in this sense would have to involve eliminativism, which pretty clearly it doesn't, or doesn't have to. But again, these are subtleties with which he doesn't really need to concern himself, as we'll see, I hope, right at the very end. Okay, others like Anaxagoras, and probably I think also Empedocles, again it's not easy to necessarily parcel these people out into these categories because they're not wholly, they're not defined with clarity. But these other people hold that they're there all along in reality, but are brought to light by separation and combination. While finally Aristotle, Chrysippus, and ultimately Hippocrates all affirm the reality of alteration, albeit in different ways, with a different underlying metaphysics, in particular having to do with the nature of mixture. Is it just the qualities that mix, or is it the bodies? Galen says, doesn't matter, you could do it either way. See, pretty hard for me. I find it hard to see how the bodies themselves could intermix, but, you know, no problem. If it does the work, that's just fine. This is what A.J. Brock, the translator in the Loeb of Natural Faculties, describes as a typical, how does he put it, a typical disregard for metaphysics. I think that's too strong. It's not that Galen disregards metaphysics, it's that he disregards what he takes to be unfounded and unnecessary subtleties in metaphysics. That's to say, I mean, he's not doing philosophy perhaps in the way that we might do it or might want to do it. But of course, the reason, well, mainly, there are two, roughly speaking, reasons why Galen is going to want to say, in a lot of cases, and he does it in all sorts of other contexts too, to simply dismiss something as theoretica, and theoretica in the pejorative sense of speculative, right? I.e. unfoundedly so. He also dismiss these things, and these are such questions as whether there's a void outside the cosmos and things of that sort, as being pointless speculations. They're pointless for two reasons. One is they're not capable of, two related reasons. They're not capable of empirical decision. And they're equally pointless because since they're not capable of empirical decision, they make no empirical difference. It doesn't matter, right? So you don't bother with that. But I think perhaps it's just importing a particular idea of metaphysics. It's too hard to say it has dismissiveness or something like that of metaphysics. It's just that he thinks that metaphysics has to, in a sense, be empirically grounded. Okay. Just going back very briefly to that. So there are two different ways in which alterations are not real. In one case, what seems to come about as a result of the alteration, a change in some perceptible property, isn't real. The perceptible properties are not real properties, Democritean view, I suppose. The other way is to say that there's no change because actually nothing happens at all. The things are there with their properties, but the things which have the properties don't change their properties. They just get separated out. And of course, the famous Anaxagorean model that the reason that cheese produces flesh is because cheese contains small bits of flesh. And what you do in digestion or the equivalent Anaxagorean process is simply to sieve out the meaty bits from the predominantly cheesy bits, which is very bad news if you're a vegetarian, of course. But common to both of these things, and that's why these two and three are pretty clearly specifications of one, are a denial of the reality of change. So what does it mean to affirm that change is real? Well, it's to say that in some basic sense, individuals can take on radically, individual things, stuffs perhaps also, can take on radically new types of quality, of poietes. Something's preserved through the change, but there's a genuine change of the subject. The subject itself changes qualitatively, and that's what alteration is. And of course, as I say, there are different ways of affirming the reality of that, and Galen says, well, it doesn't matter which one of those you take, really, as long as you affirm the reality of it. So the question is, why do you need to affirm the reality of that? Why is it so important to have genuine, as he sees it, aloiosis, rather than merely, as it were, apparent aloiosis? Well, partly, of course, because this is the view of the great Hippocrates, this actually is a passage in which he says it doesn't much matter whether what you suppose is mixed through and through, whether it's the bodies or simply their qualities, as long as you do suppose they are capable of complete intermixture. And interestingly enough, in a passage I don't quote, in On Mixtures, he says only nature is capable of complete intermixture, of a complete intermixture of, say, hot and cold, or hot and dry. We can mix things that are hot and dry and get sort of hot and dry type of mixtures, but when we do that sort of thing, what you basically get is a little bit of the hot and a little bit of the dry, small bits of the hot and small bits of the dry next to each other. For some reason, we can't effect a complete through and through mixture. Although that's not that's not particularly important to my purposes today, it does expresses another important concept, an important facet of his concept of the natural, in that sense. And indeed, in that passage in On Mixtures, he explicitly invokes God, the divine. It's the divine that can do this real work, he says. But anyway, so, immediately after this passage, you see on the bullet point, all that matters is to grasp the fact that the substance as a whole undergoes alteration, and consequently reject the view that bread, for instance, somehow already contains within itself bone and flesh and nerve, the Anaxagorean view, and equally reject the view that all perceptible properties are merely conventional or unreal. So, The particular continuous physics, of course, which he wants to adopt, is the standard continuous physics, I suppose, by this stage, generically standard of the four-quality or four-element physics. As he himself lays out in his text, The Elements According to Hippocrates, where he claims to demonstrate that Hippocrates has demonstrated that there have to be these four qualities, and indeed their associated elements, and indeed, at the level of physiology, the associated humours as well, blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. So, and one of the upshots here is that there's going to be a proliferation of powers, some of which are simply specifications of powers more generically considered. Nonetheless, the fundamental causal powers are still going to be those of the hot, the cold, the wet, and the dry. And that's not something he ever seems to want to backtrack on. Although, again, it's a further question of in what sense fundamental. It's clear that all other powers are in some sense dependent upon, perhaps even derivative of them, even if the precise nature of that dependence may be less than evident. And we're going to see an example in practice or in action of this when we get on to the treatise that Peter mentioned, Quod Animi Mores, that the powers of the soul follow upon, again a studiedly vague word, the mixtures of the body, a treatise which Peter very elegantly translated in the sadly out of print Oxford Galen. Okay, and here's an assertion of that. If you want to know which of the alterative powers are primary and elementary, they're moisture, dryness, cold, and heat. Nature constructs bone, cartilage, nerve, membrane, ligament, vein, everything else like that, in the first phase of the animal's generation, by making use of a power which is generically generative and alterative, but specifically heating, cooling, drying, and moistening. So that's what these things amount to in action. We can say, well, okay, they're generative powers because they're producing the animal. But what actually are they? Well, they're suitable combinations of heating, cooling, moistening, drying in suitable contexts and with suitable material. There's a lot of suitability about. And of course, suitable is one of those weaselly placeholder words as well. We won't ever learn. Okay. I'll leave that up, but I won't finish that. So it's the primary elementary qualities then that somehow combine initially to generate, in embryogenesis, the uniform parts of the appropriate matter. It seems to me, he says, that vein and each of the other parts act in the way it does as a result of some particular mixture of the four, hot, cold, wet, and dry. So again, there's some sort of dependence, but the question is left quite open as to what sort of dependence that might be. It's certainly not asserted that, never, I think, asserted by Galen or even suggested that this is a dependence of, or has to be thought of as a dependence of reduction, that just what it is to generate in this case is to have just this type of mixture of the four fundamental qualities. Reduction, inter-theoretic reduction, perhaps you might want to call that. I mean, it's consistent with that, but it doesn't entail it. And I'm not going to go into the extent to which he develops this story, talks about derivative or secondary material properties, I think that we described earlier today, things like hardness, softness, brittleness, lightness, weight, rarity, density, and so on, smoothness, roughness, thickness, all of these things, which are properties of things, and which, as he says, well, he claims, are well discussed by Aristotle. He's presumably thinking of Meteorology 4, which we've already mentioned today. And I'm going to pass over some stuff there. I'm going to turn to, I think is the next, yes it is, slide. So consequently, consequent on some intermediate argument, which stresses that particular types of tissue that emerge in histogenesis allied to facts of their morphology account for what it is that they're able to do in terms of altering things, and also in terms of moving things around. Again, alteration and local motion are going to be the two principal types of kinesis that are at issue here. So he says, the individual alterative powers in each animal correspond to the elementary parts, and the particular activities must correspond to each of them individually, and so too with their treae, which I dare to translate as function here. Most people don't like that very much, although I do know some biologists who do. And part of the problem is that function can be used in at least two distinct ways. I mean, you can speak of something's function in the sense of what it specifically does, and you can speak of something's function in the sense of what it's for. And it's in the latter sense that function is sometimes not a bad translation of crea. Any one of a large variety of other possibilities are very often used. All this usefulness, utility, use, need sometimes. I'm not going to say much more about crea here. There's a lot of interesting stuff to be said about crea and its relation to energia, but I don't really have time to do that, so I'm going to move on. And equally, we've looked a little bit at Genesis, on the coming to be of the animal itself, on the generation of its organic and non-organic parts, the former first, the latter. Of course, that, in a certain very obvious sense, recalls Aristotle's own account, and he uses Aristotle's language of uniformity, homoiomera. So, second power, though, is that of growth, whereby existing structures become bigger by the accretion of material, but crucially by the accretion of material in three dimensions. He's a rather nice example. He says, well, look, we can make things bigger. Kids do that when they blow up balloons. They make the balloon bigger by blowing into it. But they only make it bigger in two dimensions, because by blowing into the balloon, the balloon part, the membrane part, is thinned out. What's so special about nature is that we can build things up in three dimensions. We can't do that. And it builds things up in three dimensions, as it were, by a continuous process. It's not by just sticking bits together in the appropriate way. It's not like building a house out of bricks. And this is why he thinks, one of the reasons why he thinks, that genuine alteration is really what's important. So it's extending in every direction, in every dimension, perhaps I should translate that as, what has already come into existence, i.e. the solid parts of the body. And only nature has this power, as you see in the second of those quotations. I may come back and say a bit more about that in a moment. Finally, nutrition. This is the means, of course, by which food, nutritive material is metabolized. It functions both, of course, in growth, because if you're growing, you're going to need more of the stuff, more of the metabolized stuff, but also simply in terms of the maintenance of the structure, since we've all got a natural tendency to fall apart, increasingly so, I find, to my chagrin. But with a bit of luck, to a certain extent, our internal structures and their associated functions fight against that. They keep doing repair jobs, increasingly badly in my case, I find. So here again, you've got the... sorry, there shouldn't be an if in there. When the matter in the form of nutriment which flows into each part of the nourished body is being moulded towards it, prosodia placis, the activity is nutrition and its cause, the nutritive power. Here too, the genus of the activity is alteration, but not of the same kind as that in generation, since in that case something which did not exist previously comes into being. But in the case of nutrition, the inflowing material is assimilated into that which has already come into being, and for this reason, the first kind of alteration is reasonably called generation, and the latter assimilation, exomoiosis. And that's a pretty clear indication that Galen does think of generation as in some sense subsidiary to alteration or consequent upon alterations of a certain sort. In the second passage there, which I'm not going to read, you get even more precisions of that particular view. But this idea of assimilation is quite important. It's actually relevant to the distinction which was glanced at earlier on, perhaps more than by Philip, although Philip didn't really talk about this, the distinction that Galen makes between what constitutes the action of a drug, either a beneficial one or a poison, on the one hand, and food on the other. And it's characterized by degrees of assimilation and into what? In the case of ordinary nutrition, it's the part of the body itself that needs to be nourished that assimilates into its own type of substance, alters to its own type of substance the incoming material. Whereas in the case of drugs, the action's going the other way. In the case of drugs, either beneficial or deleterious, the parts of the body, or whatever it is that the drugs affect, are changed by the drug into something that resembles the drug itself. That's, at any rate, what he said. Okay. I'm not going to bother with that. And also important here is the fact that this can be, and indeed is, Galen thinks, a multi-stage process. The process by which raw material, food, is transformed into the various types of stuff that's needed in the body for nutrition, and then even further into the things being nourished, is a complex one. The process of converting the food goes on initially in the mouth, then in the stomach, and then in the intestines. It's continued, and at each stage you get a new elaboration of the material, and it is continued, well, in four different types of elaboration in the liver, and principally in the liver and the heart, where the stuff gets worked up into yet a new sort of thing. Its underlying features, or its underlying matter, if you like, is the same, but by processes of alteration, you actually get new types of stuff in the process. And, as I say, it can be quite a long process, because each individual type of assimilation can't take you very far. You can only assimilate in either direction into something that's pretty close to what you are already. And which is why he talks about assimilation of things which are sungana, things which are akin in the appropriate way. But again, that's not just, it is obviously, but it's not just a metaphor. The idea precisely is that big alterations take place by slow steps, and at each stage of the slow, successive steps, they have to be slow, particularly, but successive individual steps, which build on what has gone before. So, food's initially processed, I've already done that. It's converted to blood in the liver and in the veins, and distributed by the venous system throughout the body. And it's the venous blood which Galen thinks of as being, that's the proximate substance, if you like, of nutrition. It's that which gets changed into the appropriate tissues in order to regenerate those tissues. Although he says, look, you're going to need a lot of specific and distinct alterations to get bone made out of food, and even out of blood. Okay. Now, so let's go back now, after that excursus, into the distinction between the two types, or two predominant types, two generic types of physics, which he calls the two schools. And these are, of course, exactly discontinuous physicists, discontinuous physics of atomism, and fundamental unchangeability, and the physics which involves or appeals to genuine change, genuine alteration. And it's couched, of course, in passage 15 there, in terms of substance, in the sense of underlying substance. Substance subject to generation, destruction, and alteration of any sort. So it's what underlies these things. And of course, atomism of any of its varieties gives a pretty clear example of what he has in mind. And atomists don't deny, certainly Epicurus doesn't, Epicurus is more generous in this regard, of course, than Democritus, don't deny that new things come into being, things like you and me, but the fundamental level, this is just amounts to a rearrangement and an aggregation, very complex rearrangements and aggregations of bits of stuff which don't themselves change. Or don't themselves change in a real sense. Here's a particular issue. I will stop and not go on for more than another 10 minutes. There's a particular issue, he thinks, and this goes back to a discussion that, or an argument that Galen produces in Elements According to Hippocrates, which basically goes like this. You can't give an account of, well, a whole variety of things. He's particularly interested in pain, because that's something that is talked about early on in the treatise Nature of Man. You can't give an account of pain, he thinks, unless you suppose that things are subject to genuine change. What could pain consist in? Supposing you take a needle and poke something which is constructed as the atomists say it is, what's going to happen? Well, the needle's going to hit something solid and hard and resistive, and unchangeable, unaffectable in the appropriate sense, namely an atom, or it's going to go between two atoms. Well, neither of those, Galen thinks, could conceivably be painful. Now, he of course underestimates the possible resources of certain types of emergentism there, I think, but it's an interestingly robust sort of argument. And he thinks it applies also to all sorts of things that we would think of perhaps in some senses being emergent, and that's what I'm going to go on with in a moment, such as sentience itself, consciousness. And in a particularly characteristically robust stretch of argument, he says these people do away with anything that's worth having, like free will and virtue and things of that sort. And indeed, he claims, although it's not clear who he's talking about, that some of the people in this one school really do just talk in terms of absolutely adamantine input-output models for what happens, in the response to perceptual information. It's just that the perceptual information causes a certain set of changes, and then the animal does something. And that's all on this view. Now, whether any of this is fair to atomism or to all varieties of atomism is surely debatable. But Galen surely is right, I think, that there is a sense of alteration, genuine alteration, you might call it, which they must eschew at some level from their ontology, precisely because they say, look, fundamental to our system are things which don't change. At least don't change in quality. They change position, of course, but changing position isn't the same as changing quality. We've already seen. So, as I stressed a moment ago, they can't give any account, Galen thinks, of things like consciousness, the will, and so on. But equally, he thinks they can't give any satisfying account of ordinary physiological processes. These things are too complicated and too specific to be reducible to, and reducible again in a strong sense, I take it, to simple facts about the motion, the kinetic behaviour of very small bits of unchanging stuff. And this, finally, is the upshot of that, and I think I've got about 3 minutes, yes, I've got about 3 or 5 minutes, is, it's the quotation I'm talking about here, we must understand then. And there are two types of attraction, and this goes back to claims I was making on Galen's behalf earlier on. One in virtue of the tendency of an empty space to be refilled, the infamous horror of vacui, the other by way of the appropriate quality. Air is drawn into a bellows in the first manner, while iron is attracted by the magnet, he says, in the other. And while the tendency of the emptied space to be refilled acts primarily on what is lighter, that in virtue of the appropriate quality frequently draws the heavier, if that is what is by nature more akin to it. You've got to have something somewhere in your explanatory mechanisms, or at least through explanatory frameworks, which will account for why in certain cases particular organs accumulate heavier materials, or heavier materials. It can't be done in terms of this particular, specific, wholly mechanical principle, if that's what it is. I mean, that's an open question too, but I don't want to get into that particular can of worms. Okay, I'm going to turn very, very briefly, and I promise I will to the treatise we were talking about before, that the powers of the soul follow the mixtures of the body, known usually nowadays by the initials of its misleading Latin title, Quod Animum Moris, QAM. Okay. So, as I've already noted, it's not precisely clear what follow means, but let's have a quick look, and it will be a quick look, at a couple of texts. Okay, first of all, this one. The origin of everything I'm going to talk about, he says, is the knowledge of those evident actions and affections, erga kai pathē, of the soul, Aristotelian language, of course, in small children, as a result of which its powers become evident. For some of them, the children, and we're supposed to think of pretty young children, are very cowardly and timid, while some are insatiable and gluttonous, and some are quite the opposite, and so on. Some are shameless, others are modest. This is a version of the so-called cradle argument, of course. This should suffice by way of example to show that in very small children there exist by nature opposite powers of the three parts of the soul. This is Platonism coming out, of course, from which one may infer that the nature of the soul is not the same for all. For if its substance was invariable for them, they would exhibit the same activities and undergo the same affections as a result of the same causes. That's the crucial operative principle. And different output presupposes different input or different mediation, or both. this is actually an important one. This is one that goes back to the issues that were raised earlier on by Anna. But on this point, the differentiation of natural powers, philosophers are immediately, Euthyphros, confused, since they have an unarticulated notion of power. They seem to me to imagine that a power inhabits a substance as we do a house. Not really. So there again is a mistake. There is some sort of reification, hypostasization, if you like, of powers, of which Peter was mentioning earlier on. Not realizing that the productive cause, itia poetica, of each occurrence is conceived of in the category of relation, and while the category of the cause may be specific and per se, the power of what comes to be is in relation to that which comes to be from it. And I should stress that the translation here is extremely difficult to get right. Peter has a very different translation, which also it does a similar sort of job, so I don't think it matters too much at the end. Okay. For this reason, we say that substance possesses as many powers as there are activities. For example, aloe has these various powers in relation to various different things, according to how it's applied, where it's applied, what sort of conditions it's applied to. It has as many powers as there are these specific effects of those powers. Okay. Now, okay. So, crucial thing there is, as I say, it doesn't matter how finely or coarsely grained our approach is in a variety of different ways to the individuation of powers. We can speak of them generically, specifically. Perception is a genus of which sight is a species, and so on. And perception is itself a type of alteration, so it's going to be a multi-leveled process. But perceptual powers are powers, indeed, of the soul. That's also important, but again, I can't follow that out now. So even if we may speak of them as though they were things, this is more in the spirit of the way Peter translates the crucial sentences, even though we may speak of them as though they were things, we can talk about the power of such and such, we can nominalize it, we should resist the temptation then to hypostasize it. To say that aloe has the power to fly is to say no more and no less than it is able to do something, flying. Effectively, the nominalized power disappears into the predicate, and the only real thing there is the substance of the aloe itself, and that, fundamentally, some sense of fundamentally, will be a matter of its particular mixtures, the mixtures that go to make up it, the separate parts of the aloe and the mixtures, and so on and so forth. So powers, if this is right, are properties of substances or natures, dispositional, causal, and relational properties, manifested in the abilities of these substances to produce specific outcomes in particular cases. That's what I take to be the upshot of that for Gabe. Now, he goes on to say, well, this doesn't actually rule out Platonism. You can hold this view and still believe, and it's consistent, in some sense of consistent, with the Platonist view of the nature of the soul. Namely, the soul is, or at least the rational part of it, is immaterial. That's to say, as long as you just say it can do whatever it needs to do to produce these effects, you can say it is immaterial. But he says he finds it personally very difficult to see how on earth that could be the case. No one can deny, and this includes Platonists, and indeed Plato himself, he cites the Timaeus, a bit selectively, but he cites the Timaeus, are perfectly happy to agree that physical things and physical occurrences, alterations, have psychological effects. One of his favourite examples, as it is indeed mine, is wine. Wine has interesting psychotropic effects. These are going to be effects on your incorporeal rational soul, if you're Plato, and perhaps on other bits of your soul as well, of course. But clearly what it is to be wine is a matter of, Galen thinks, of exhibiting some sort of mixture of the fundamental qualities. Of course, here the crucial interaction question crops up. How can material things affect non-material things? And indeed vice versa. So he doesn't think that immaterialist dualism is ruled out by this description of states of affairs at this level. He does think that it runs into, as it were, initial difficulties of intelligibility, conceivability. Crucially, what seems to be unintelligible is just how it can do these things. Okay. Right. Let me just very I'll just say one more thing. So, what's the upshot of all of this? Well, first of all, obviously, that Galen's powers are a mixed bag, some basic, some derivative, some generic, some specific, some natural, some psychic, and so on. If materialism is correct, and he certainly leans towards materialism in this treatise, more so than perhaps anywhere else, then soul will just be a mixture of the physical components, but one which is such as to take on a distinctive range of distinctively psychic properties. So there'll be distinctive psychic properties that will be emergent on facts about physiological specifications. So does then Galen's theory involve a full reduction, or emergence, or supervenience? Well, the question, of course, is anachronistic, and to some extent it might very well appear misplaced, indeed for more than one reason. If Galen were presented with such a range of options, insofar as he understood them, but he probably would have done, he was a clever bloke, it's easy to suppose that he would have said, well, he didn't know, and what's more, he didn't care, it doesn't matter. That's doing the sort of metaphysics that's a waste of one's time. But there's just a little bit more to be said than that. Whatever we're to say about the composition of sensible substance, the complexity of the structures and their standing in specific relations to one another at least provide a framework for a causal analysis of their workings in terms of mixtures and their powers. It's only a framework. But one thing remains non-negotiable, he thinks, and that's the commitment to a continuous physics which involves genuine alteration, however conceived, at the fundamental level, whatever that is. That's not reducible, but a fundamental metaphysical fact, he thinks. Yes. Finally, let me just talk my way a moment through this slide. It's what I call elsewhere the ban on generic emergence. There are certain things, he says, that you can't have. And it's interesting to see what he thinks they are. This is from Elements According to Hippocrates, and this is about the relationship between fundamental physical facts and sentience. So he says there are the following four possibilities. This is 1A, 1B, and 2A and 2B. The body is built up from things both insentient and unaltered, or B, from things that are sentient and unaltered, of which the common factor is from things unaltered. So having shown that to be impossible, so if I can show that sentience must involve alteration at some level, then there are only going to be two options left, namely, one which constructs the perceiving body from primary elements that were both sentient and altered, I mean, some sort of panpsychism, and the second from altered but insentient elements. There are two possibilities here. And what's the ban on generic emergence? Well, it's just this. He does this by way of example. He said, well, look, there are certain sorts of things which are such that the macro-level property is clearly, as it were, simply an aggregative result of various lower-level facts. Not distinct facts, but the same facts. So a surface is red in virtue of the fact that any part of it is red, he claims. Not, of course, unexceptionably, but he thinks that is unexceptional. A nicer example, I think, is the following one. Any house has a shape, has a particular shape. Shape isn't the sort of thing that could, just as it were, completely emerge, because it have no basis in underlying facts of the matter. Why not? Well, houses are built out of things that have shapes. So any part of a house will necessarily have some shape or another, but of course it won't necessarily be house-shaped. You're not going to have fractal houses, right? So that's what I mean by generic. There's no such thing as generic emergence. You can't just have something as general as shape emerging, in a strong sense of it, of emerge, super being perhaps even. But there can be certain kinds of, but within genera, emergence of this sort is tolerable. That's, I think, so far as it goes, an interesting and perhaps even a defensible point of view. It provides a framework within which you can talk about the mixtures of the qualities being fundamental and also talk about higher order, if you like, powers which are dependent upon them. Of course, the precise nature of the dependency may not be known. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry, I went on a bit long there.